Welcome to episode 1482 of the 1010 Thrive podcast, brought to you by 1010 Thrive Ministries. 1010 Thrive, 10 minutes a day, based on 10 guidelines for abundant living. In our last episode, Salome introduces her sons through a nickname Jesus gave them, the Sons of Thunder. They grew up in the security of Zebedee's successful fishing business, shaped by their father's steadiness and mother's intensity. So their eventual decision to leave everything for Jesus was not an escape from an empty life, but a choice to pursue something they believed was greater. For John, that journey began with John the Baptist. Acts of the Apostles, Part 6, Chapter 2.
The Baptist was preparing disciples whom he expected eventually to leave him. And then one day, the leaving came. He was preaching and baptizing as usual when he saw Jesus walking past and said,
"Behold, the Lamb of God."
Two of his disciples heard him. Andrew was one, my John was the other. They understood what their teacher was doing. He was not losing disciples to a rival rabbi. He was completing the work for which he had gathered them. The teacher who had taught them to watch was telling them, "Look, the one we have been waiting for is here." So they followed Jesus. There is something beautiful to me in the thought that my son's first great teacher taught him, finally, how to leave his teacher. The Baptist had never asked young men to build their lives around him. He had taught them to recognize the Messiah when he came. And when Jesus appeared, the Baptist did what every faithful teacher must eventually be willing to do. He stepped aside and pointed his disciples towards someone greater. My son went to the Jordan looking for a teacher who could help him understand what God was doing. He came home having found the one God was doing it through.
I need to be baptized by you, and do you come to me?
Let it be so for now, for thus it is fitting for us to fulfill all righteousness.
This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased.
I was not there that morning. I want to say that plainly, because the account in Matthew's Gospel gives the impression of a clean, witnessed scene. Two brothers mending nets, a voice, the leaving. I heard about it afterward. By the time I knew what had happened, the boat was already short of two of the men who should have been in it. I went to find Zebedee. He was doing what he always did when something overwhelming happened. Working, moving the nets, methodical, his face doing the thing it did when he was feeling something he did not have words for. Zebedee, did you know?
I saw them go.
That was all he said. I did not push him further. There are things a man watches that take time to become words, and Zebedee was not a man who forced words to come before they were ready. He had watched his sons walk away from everything he had built for them, and he had let them go. I have thought about that a great deal in the years since. His letting them go. It is not a small thing, a father watching his sons choose something over their inheritance. He could have called them back. He had hired men, yes, but he needed his sons. And he did not call them back. I think he saw something in them that morning that he had always known was there, that the lake was not large enough for them, that something had been waiting for them that was larger than nets and boats and the family trade, and that whatever else a father is, he is someone who, if he loves well enough, eventually opens his hands. I followed them, not immediately, not the morning they left the boat, but in time. Because the stories that came back were not the kind of stories a mother can receive at a distance through second-hand accounts and feel that she has understood them. The feeding of the thousands, the healing of the man born blind, a dead girl walking out of a room where Jesus had taken only 3 of the 12, my sons among them, and spoken to her. I needed to see what they were becoming. And I needed to see the man who was making them become it. What I found, when I finally joined the group of women who travelled with the ministry, was not what I expected. Not because it was less than the stories, because a story can only tell you what happened. It cannot tell you what it felt like to be in the room when it was happening. It cannot tell you what it was like to watch my sons sit at this man's feet and become slowly, and with great difficulty and considerable backsliding, something closer to what they had always been trying to be. I am getting ahead of myself. Let me go back to those early days. In the beginning, what struck me most was how ordinary so much of it looked. They walked. They ate. They slept wherever someone would receive them. Jesus taught in synagogues and houses and on hillsides, and people came carrying every kind of need. My sons had imagined, I think, that following the Messiah would mean standing near the centre of history. Much of the time it meant managing crowds, finding food, and walking another 10 miles. Then there were the moments when the ordinary world seemed to open. I remember hearing about the night on the lake. A storm had come down suddenly, violent enough to terrify men who had spent their lives on that water. That mattered to me. James and John had known storms since childhood. If they were frightened, they believed they might die. And Jesus was asleep. John told me how they woke him, how he stood and spoke to the wind and water, and how the lake became still. I asked what he thought when it happened. He was quiet before answering.
I think the storm frightened me less before it stopped.
That was John. The greater question was no longer what kind of storm could drown them, but what kind of man could tell a storm to stop. That question followed them everywhere. They watched him touch lepers when everyone else moved away. They watched him eat with tax collectors and sinners and refused to be embarrassed by the company he kept. They watched crowds press around him until there was scarcely room to move, and then watched him notice one frightened person inside the crowd as though no one else were there, and they listened. That may have been the greater change. My sons had never lacked opinions. James especially had never suffered from uncertainty about what he thought, but increasingly they came home with things Jesus had said rather than things they themselves had concluded. Blessed are the meek. Love your enemies. Whoever wants to be first must become a servant of all. Lose your life to find it. Those were difficult teachings for my sons. Not because they were cruel men. They were not. But they cared fiercely about what was right. And fierce people often find mercy more difficult than justice. Justice identifies the wrong and demands that something be done about it. Mercy sometimes asks you to remain near the person who committed it. I saw how difficult that lesson remained when a Samaritan village refused to receive Jesus because he was traveling toward Jerusalem. James and John were furious.
Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them?
When I heard about it, I closed my eyes. There are moments when a mother discovers that adulthood has not removed nearly as much childhood from her children as she had hoped. Jesus rebuked them. My sons loved him fiercely, but their love still wanted enemies. They were willing to defend him, fight for him, perhaps even die for him. What they had not yet learned was how to love people who rejected him. And Jesus kept teaching them. That is what I remember most clearly about those years. Not simply what my sons saw him do, but what he was doing to them. James's strength was still there. John's intensity was still there. The thunder had not disappeared, but Jesus was beginning to give it a direction. I could see the change. I could also see what had not changed. They believed his kingdom was coming. They believed he was the Messiah. And somewhere inside all that sacrifice and loyalty and genuine love for him, another thought had begun to grow. If the kingdom was coming, where would they stand when it arrived? I understood the question, more than I would later wish to admit. Because I had watched them leave the boat, I had watched them surrender the future their father had prepared for them and follow Jesus wherever he went. I had watched them give themselves to something they believed would change Israel and perhaps the world. And somewhere along the way, without quite noticing when it happened, I began doing what mothers have done since the world began. I started wondering what all of that might mean for my sons.
James and John remind us that following Jesus does not mean every part of us changes at once. They had left their boats, surrendered their security, listened to his teaching, witnessed his power, and genuinely loved him. Yet ambition, anger, and the desire for recognition still traveled with them. Jesus did not reject them because their transformation was incomplete. He kept teaching them, correcting them, and redirecting the very qualities that sometimes led them astray. The same is true for us. Christ does not simply ask us to abandon what is obviously wrong. He reaches deeper, into the good things that have become mixed with self-interest. Our loyalty can still want recognition. Our passion for justice can become anger. Even our service can quietly begin asking what we will receive in return. Discipleship means allowing Jesus to expose those mixtures without walking away from him when he does. The encouraging truth is that Jesus already knew what James and John would become. He saw beyond the ambition and the thunder to courage, faithfulness, and love that had not yet fully emerged. He does the same with us. He meets us as we are, but loves us too deeply to leave our desires untouched, patiently shaping what we bring him until we begin to want not merely a place beside him, but a life that looks like his. To be continued.